My neighbour, for example, she was amazing, but she wasn't a very spiritual lady, actually. We're in and out of each other's houses. And she came over to me one day and said, "Charlie, I think there might be an evil spirit in my house," which was completely out of the blue, kind of. I'm thinking, wow, we've not had conversations like this before. So I said to her, "I could come and pray in your house. We could ask for the peace of Jesus to come." And she was a bit like, "Oh, I don't know about that. I think I'll call a Quranic expert to come and help." So I said, no, I'll come. It will help. And I went over to her house and I start to pray in her house in the name of Jesus. And as I pray, this enormous picture on her wall jumped off the wall and hit her. And it was kind of crazy. I was like, wow, God, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And she says to me, "Charlie, you're making it worse. I think we need to stop." And I didn't actually have much experience in this kind of prayer. And I'm thinking, what do I do, Jesus?
Hi, guys. Welcome back to Raw Mission. If you're new, Frontiers is a community of Jesus followers who've committed by God's grace to sharing the gospel with Muslims, making disciples, planting churches, and catalyzing movements. We're made up of 12 to 1300 adults and more than 800 children on 270 teams on the field. We're from over 50 different nationalities and we serve in over 60 countries. In this podcast, we want to show you places around the world where the good news of Jesus is simply not known. Areas where there are literally millions of Muslims who are gospel-deprived, gospel-starved. We want to show you what God is up to, how his kingdom is expanding and growing, even in the most unlikely places, through ordinary people who are just like you. Today I've got a colleague with me who spent many years living with her family in Jerusalem. Charlotte will be sharing about life there with a young family, living in a city considered to be sacred by Jews, Muslims, and Christians. Well, good morning, Charlotte. It's great to have you in the studio with us today.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing your story. You're a colleague with us here in the office, but you spent many years overseas in the Middle East as well, right?
Yes, that's right. We were in Jordan for 2 years and then Jerusalem for 4 years.
Great. Well, let's go back and hear all about how you got interested in mission. Did you grow up in a Christian home?
So I always went to church. My mum came to faith when I was about 12 or 13 through Alpha and some of those influences in the Anglican church. And we went to Spring Harvest for several years after that. And that was where I first encountered mission and heard about working overseas, the need to share Jesus with people who don't know him.
As a sort of teenager then, as a late teenager?
Yeah, I was about 15, probably the first time I really heard that message and it really spoke to me. And that was the first time I really felt God calling me into mission. Yeah, and it really did stick with me. It wasn't just a thing as a young person that appealed, but I think that was a real calling from God right from that early age.
And how did you start thinking that Muslims might be what God was calling you to?
So I had always felt called to mission, but Muslims had never really been on my radar. I didn't really know much about Islam or Muslims. And when I went to university, in my first year at university, I met my now husband and we were friends and he invited me and a lot of my other friends to go on a mission trip to Morocco. And that was kind of one of these wild mission trips as students. We all got in a Land Rover. We drove across France into Morocco. And we just slept under the stars. We all went out and took no money or possessions with us, as it says in the Gospels, go out. And we just lived by faith for a few days and we met people and we shared Jesus with them. And we really prayed over that region. And I think that was my first experience of meeting Muslims and just realizing the real need that there was to share Jesus with people who just had no other way of hearing about him.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I did the same thing at university. Yeah, one of those World Horizons, was it?
One of those trips.
Yeah, ours was a minibus, not quite a Land Rover like yours. Great. Okay, and what did you study at university?
So I studied Spanish and Arabic. And then halfway through, I gave up the Spanish and decided just to focus on the Arabic because I sensed that God was calling me to work amongst Muslims, possibly in the Arab world. So then I focused my studies on that. And as part of that, I went over to Egypt. Again, that was with World Horizons. I did a placement with them over in Egypt and spent 4 months there.
What was that like for you?
It was really interesting, actually. At the same time that I was there, there was several Brazilians who were part of this amazing project called the Radicals. And they had come as a team and they lived off shared support. And they were just the most phenomenal bunch of a lot of women, actually, but also some couples. And we lived together and prayed together. And yeah, we just saw God move there, which was amazing.
Oh, that's really cool. So even though it was a university placement, it was okay that you were doing sort of mission stuff out there, or were you doing something else for the university?
Yeah, so I was studying language during the most mornings, and then we were supposed to kind of get into the culture and meet people. Egypt, there's a lot of English spoken, so actually probably doing the mission stuff, I actually ended up speaking more Arabic than most of the other people on my course, because I was actually able to mix with locals and get into homes.
That's really cool. Where were you in Egypt? Were you in one of the big cities?
I was in Cairo.
Yeah.
So yes, very big city, very busy, and yeah, a bit crazy, to be honest.
Yeah, but you did okay with that, did you? You sort of adjusted to living in a massive Arab-speaking city.
Yeah, I made some lovely friends, single girls there, who invited me into their homes. And I think at the time, I was just quite ready to do anything. So I would accept invitations to go and stay with people. Went to some of the really poor areas of Cairo. Remember one time staying overnight with this family, and there was a huge fight in the street, and everyone came out on the balcony, and then people in the street are throwing chairs, and it was like this massive excitement, and that was the most exciting thing that had happened all week. And yeah, it was just crazy, but it was just amazing just to be able to get into people's homes and yeah, just to sort of share bits of my story with them and just learn about the culture and just be part of people's lives there. So that was really an amazing experience.
Okay. So, I mean, some people would say, wow, being in a big city like Cairo as a single girl would be a bit scary, but, you know, fights in the streets and so on, but you weren't too fazed by it?
There were some moments where it was quite difficult. I did have someone follow me home a couple of times, and as a kind of feisty student, I just turned around and said to him, what are you doing? And he told me this whole story about how his friend had followed someone home and now they were married.
Oh,
and I explained that would not be happening here. And could he perhaps go away? And there were some moments where it was hard to be a single woman in that environment. But I had a really supportive group of people around me who kind of helped me to adapt culturally. And just being part of that team was really helpful, and just be able to process some of those kind of more stressful situations was really helpful.
Yeah. And presumably you weren't often on your own because you had friends.
No. And a part of our team ethos was we always tried to be in pairs. And if we would visit, we would try and go as pairs and just keep each other safe and look out for each other.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. And so that was during your university years, like a bit of a time out, I suppose. Was it like often language students do a third year out and then come back for their fourth year?
Yeah, that's right. So we had a 4-month placement for that time. And then, yeah, I went back into university.
And did you get married soon after university?
Yes. So actually I got married so I was doing a 4-year course and I got married after my third year at university. My husband had finished university already.
Okay.
And then he actually decided to go back to university because we had this joint calling to work with Muslims. He wanted to study Arabic. That was actually how we'd met. He had just done a very short course in Arabic, really enjoyed it. And so he then went back to study. So we then returned to Egypt for his placement as a married couple.
Interesting. How different was that then?
It was interesting. I found actually as a single woman, I did get a lot more invites into people's homes.
Yeah.
And it was easier to actually pursue those friendships. My husband is not really a big city kind of person, so he wasn't totally loving being in Cairo. But yeah, we had different opportunities to meet couples. We made some good friends there. And we were part of the team again that was out there, which was amazing. That was kind of our first experience as a couple of being part of a team. And getting used to life in the Arab world together.
Okay, so how did you end up finding us at Frontiers and joining and leading eventually a team with us?
Well, it's actually funny. So we knew we wanted to go overseas. We were looking at how we would do that. And my husband was planning to actually join the Foreign Office. Mm-hmm. And he'd been through the whole process of application. He'd been offered a job. And then it was 2008 when the economic crash hit. And out of the blue, he got a letter saying, we're going to have to make some redundancies. Anyone who hasn't started will be the kind of first cut. Mm-hmm. So we had then to make a whole new life plan because we had been planning to go and work overseas in that capacity. And we had a friend actually who wanted to go to a Frontiers conference. And she just called us out of the blue and said, I'm going to this conference. Would you like to come with me? She actually had no connection to Frontiers. She just read about it and thought it looked interesting. And we happened to be going on holiday the day after, and it was on our kind of route that we were going to be driving anyway. So we said, oh yeah, we'll come with you and we'll meet you there and we'll go to this conference. So that was our first experience.
Yeah. And what happened next?
Well, actually, so another couple who are now part of the sending base here in the international office, they were back from their overseas home and they were sharing a little bit about their lives. And the opening verse that they shared was from Isaiah, and it was a verse that was really important to us and had been one of our kind of calling verses into ministry. And so we kind of heard that and thought, oh, well, God maybe is speaking to us about this. So we decided to pursue finding out more about Frontiers. And actually then, but when we came back from holiday, we then had a meeting with the sending base directors. Mm. And yeah, we just loved the team ethos and yeah, just the way that Frontiers did things. So we moved quite quickly after that, actually. Yeah. We pretty much signed up straight away.
And had Jerusalem been on your agenda at all and in your thoughts up to that point?
I think from our studies of the Arab world, it was somewhere that we had an interest in. Mm. We were looking at all different Arab kind of nations. We knew that we wanted to focus on the Arab world. Mm. So we had spoken about perhaps going to Jerusalem, but there weren't any teams there at the time and it was very hard to get a visa. Mm. So we did a vision trip to Jordan. And we felt that that would be a good kind of landing place, a place to improve our language, find out exactly where we felt called and kind of prepare for leading a team in the future. We knew that we wanted to lead a team, but we just wanted to have some experience on the ground before we did that.
Yeah, that's wise. And Jordan is a good place to either learn Arabic from scratch or to brush up, I suppose. Were you at that time trying to work out, do we work in, well, I mean, you mentioned the Foreign Office, but well, I suppose there are lots of things you could do with United Nations or Foreign Office or British Council, perhaps. Or were you beginning to think about poverty and refugees and so on?
So we kind of went with an open mind. I've always had a real heart for refugees. And we did language learning through a language centre and learning language through spending time with a local person and learning in Arabic. And we actually met a local lady who worked for the UN and she invited us to come and teach English in a refugee camp up in the north of Jordan. Mm-hmm. So that seemed like a really good opportunity to kind of find out, yeah, did we want to work with refugees and just to experience life in a refugee camp?
Mm. Were they Palestinian refugees up in northern Jordan?
Yes. So they were refugees from a long time ago. A lot of them were from Gaza originally. But that was back in the 60s. They had been in Jordan for a long time. Mm. But there was a real mentality in the refugee camp that eventually they would be able to move home. So the refugee camp had no sewage system. The houses all had tin roofs. Mm-hmm. No work had been done in the camp because there was this very strong feeling that, oh, eventually we will move back. Mm. And so the whole camp was kind of living in limbo. And the UN was doing English classes, community development, trying to improve education in the camp. And so they invited us to come and be part of that and to teach them English up there.
Hmm. Did you find it pretty easy connecting with, you know, the Palestinian people?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was a very conservative area, which made it quite difficult. So my husband couldn't be invited into a home by a woman, even if I was present with him, because it was that conservative. And so I would make home visits to some of the ladies and I got to know them very well. They shared a lot of their lives with me. Actually, the lady that then went on to teach us Arabic. So we were teaching English and then she said that she would love to teach us Arabic. And she said to me that she loved teaching us Arabic so much because it was like a window to another world that she wasn't able to experience because she lived in this very enclosed environment. And Yeah, she just got to see something new and it really gave her life to be able to do that.
Mm. That's really good. Any interesting stories from that time?
Yeah, it was an interesting kind of learning culture. So we had some really good friends, neighbours who lived across the road from us. And we had a moment where they said, oh, our grandma has died. We'd love you to come to the funeral. And so we said to a teammate who had been there a lot longer than us, oh, what do we do in this situation? So they told us the appropriate things to say and what we should wear. But they neglected to tell us that funerals are done in segregated fashion, males and females alone. So my husband and I turned up on the doorstep, bringing the appropriate gifts. We said all the appropriate things, sat down together, and then realized that, in fact, he was the only man in the whole room. It was a very awkward moment. So yes, they produced some small boys to make him feel less uncomfortable about the situation. And they were very gracious about it. But yeah, there were so many cultural learning points like that in that time where we just found things that we didn't know. And we didn't know we didn't know about the culture.
Until it was too late. Yeah. Mm. Okay. And so 2 years, was it, in Jordan?
Yes, we lived in Jordan for 2 years. And we were kind of part of a training team. So it was an amazing team. I think between the three couples who were leading it, they probably had over 100 years of experience on the field, and they were some of the founding members of Frontiers. So it was an amazing learning experience being part of that team. But the agreement all along had been that after 2 years, we would go and lead a new team in a completely unreached area where there were no workers already.
Mm, okay. So had they been seeing any fruit amongst the Palestinians in the north where you'd been?
It was probably, I'd say, more of a seed sowing time. There was another couple who worked up there with us, and we didn't see any real fruit at the time. There was a lot of sharing, a lot of praying. In fact, Jordan was the place that really I learned to pray, which was a kind of foundational thing for actually the rest of my time overseas. I'd always prayed, but when I moved to Jordan, I just discovered just a new love for prayer and a depth, actually, of prayer and praying into these unreached situations, which completely changed my outlook, actually, on prayer.
Okay. So, yeah, tell us about how the move went from there across to Jerusalem.
Well, we did a vision trip to Jerusalem. We decided to just cross by the land border because, actually, Amman and Jerusalem are very close together, but they're separated by a kind of very hard border. And so we thought, oh, we'll just go and visit our friends. They're working in a refugee camp in Bethlehem. Be a good place to explore. Do we want to go and move there? And we got to the border and we just said, oh, we're going to Bethlehem. And we had no idea that that was not a good thing to say to a border guard when you're entering Jerusalem. So they held us there for 11 hours questioned us. And it was a good time to think, do we really want to move here? And eventually they agreed that we could go into the country. And we did. We got to spend some time just visiting different places. And I think, yeah, God just really put that place on our heart. We had been looking at some other countries, mostly working with refugees, different situations. Mm. But that was the place we really felt that God called us to.
Mm. I suppose if you're considering moving to Jerusalem and those environments around there, that experience, 11 hours stuck at a border, being told to wait, being interrogated, that gives you quite a bit of understanding of how Palestinians face their daily lives sometimes, whether they've been refugees in another country or they're somewhere else within Israel, the Gaza Strip, or wherever else. Because, yeah, I mean, Israel, sadly, as we know, with so much, you know, war going on nowadays, but for years there've been boundaries and walls and fences and issues just with traveling through the country. And so I suppose that was a first taste for you of what life can be like in Israel.
Yeah, that's right. And it was, that was one of the most difficult parts of living there, actually, was that everywhere is very segregated and there are a lot of controls and borders and a lot of waiting and being checked and things that you can't do. As part of our kind of vision of going there, we wanted to live among Palestinians and I guess understand what life was like for them as well. And I guess we see that Jesus incarnated, he came to live amongst us as humans, and we wanted to also be able to just step into the life experience of the people that we wanted to reach with the gospel and just get some understanding. And I think when we moved there, we didn't really understand exactly how that would be. And there were times when it was really difficult. And I think we probably grew a lot actually in our relationship with God in that as well, because there were so many situations where you are just out of control. You're at the hands of the border guards, or you have to just do what you're told. And that actually is quite difficult for someone who's grown up in a country where we don't have so many strict controls.
Yeah, interesting. So, I mean, many of our listeners, you know, will be as confused as I am by the whole situation in Israel. There's so much history, so much politics. But many of us wouldn't even think that, oh, to work amongst Palestinians, you would move into Jerusalem itself as a city. So tell us about Jerusalem. What does that look like in terms of peoples?
So it's a very interesting place. It's divided into Jewish areas, mostly in the west side, and then Palestinian Arab areas, which are mostly in the east side. So when we moved there, my husband was actually studying at the Hebrew University. So there was another couple working on the other side of the city, and they'd said to us, well, these are some areas you might consider moving into. There's no one living there. It's very interesting because the Hebrew University, and then there was an area that was very Jewish, but all the surrounding areas were Palestinian. Mm. And so we just picked one of these areas. We felt that that was where God was leading us. And we kind of thought, oh, it must be very similar to Jordan. So we just thought we'd find an apartment the same way we had in Jordan. And we just walked into this neighborhood. We prayed, asked God to just show us where to live. And we just stumbled across someone who had an apartment that they wanted to let. And so we felt that this was a real opening from God. It was very near the university. It was very good location for us. But we just hadn't realized how closed some of the Palestinian areas were in that area. So in my first newsletter home, I thought, oh, I'm going to Google map this area. And then I can put a picture and show everyone exactly where we live. It'll be really interesting for our supporters. Hmm. And as I Googled it, all these images came up of people who'd been beaten and were in hospital. And we realized that this was such a closed area that actually nobody who wasn't from a Palestinian background ever actually went into this area. And there was a real culture of mistrust of people from the outside. So any Jewish person who had accidentally wandered in, there was all these pictures of them in hospital. And then we shared with some friends we'd made. We went to a expat church for a little while there. And they all said to us, you can't live there. Are you actually crazy? Mm. And we just had no idea that that's what the situation was there and how segregated life is in that place.
Mm. That's interesting. Tell us more stories about just life there than in East Jerusalem, was it?
Yeah, it was East Jerusalem. So we were very near the Mount of Olives, actually, which most people don't realize is actually a Palestinian area. So we moved into this area, and it was actually easier for me as a woman than it was for my husband. So he would often walk up to university and people would kind of accost him and threaten him. And as soon as he spoke Arabic, it would be instant welcome. But until they realized that he spoke Arabic and he wasn't a threat to them. Mm. He felt it was quite scary on occasion. And there was a lot of that kind of experience for him. For me, it was just hard to get to know women. And so I was also working actually for a reconciliation organization on the other side of the city, which I can tell you a little bit more about later. But I used to have to get a bus on the days I was working there out of this kind of little suburb area. And buses there were quite different from how you'd imagine them. It's more like a coach. And there would be two or three coaches that would leave this area and hundreds of people would kind of squash into them. And it was kind of first come, first serve. So everyone would be pushing to get on the coach. And I was waiting for this bus one day. And also something that I haven't mentioned is actually that the whole time we were in Jordan and before that, we hadn't been able to have children. So we moved to Jerusalem. We just thought we can live wherever we like. We're a couple with no children. And as soon as I got there, I discovered that I was pregnant and I was going to have a baby. And I didn't realize actually, since I've now got three children, I've become more aware But I actually faint quite a lot when I'm pregnant. So I'm standing in this bus queue and I just blacked out. And there's hundreds of people around me and it's kind of this very dangerous area. We haven't been there that long. I don't know many people.
Yeah.
And I sort of am able to say, kind of help, as I'm lying on the floor. But I kept sort of blacking out. And someone picked me up and just put me into this blacked out van. And I kind of remember thinking semi-consciously, am I being kidnapped or are they helping me? And I really didn't know. But I was so kind of half blacked out that at that point, I just thought, well, I just have to go with it.
Yeah,
what else can I do? So unfortunately, I was not being kidnapped. Mm. And I was taken to the medical center. And they said to me, oh, can we call someone? So my husband was in an exam at the time. So I kind of thought, oh, I don't want to disturb him. Afterwards, he said, you should have just called anyway. But I said, I'll go and get my landlady because I didn't know many people. Mm. So they went to get her, but she wasn't available. So they got my next door neighbor and she came rushing in and she said to me, she's wearing the full kind of abaya and very Muslim. And when the doctor went out, she said to me, Charlie, I'm wearing my pajamas under here. I just rushed out so quickly to come and rescue you. And she just came and we'd kind of interacted a little bit, but not very much until that point. But that was kind of a opening point. She took me home and looked after me. And then she felt that she needed to look after me after that. Mm. She sort of adopted me as a sister. Sweet. And she cooked for me all the time. And wherever I went in town, I'd meet people then who would say, oh, you're the foreigner that fainted. My brother's cousins, whatever, helped you and they did this. And so I had this connection point into people's lives. And it was such a poor area that none of the women worked. They all stayed at home.
Yeah, right.
And so it was actually quite easy then. I had a sort of open invitation into community. Mm-hmm. And people spent a lot of the day cleaning their houses and cooking and having coffee and chatting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of an open door then. This lady introduced me to all of the other neighbours. And I think everyone then felt quite protective of me because they were so worried that I was going to get ill again that they all felt they had to kind of welcome me in and protect me.
But I love that because that's what we want to do, isn't it? We want to go, of course, bringing good news, but not feeling this sense that we have everything and you have nothing. But to, you know, we want to go and need help as well. Especially when we get there, we really do need help. We don't understand language, culture, where to go, how to get the bus. But I mean, yours was potentially more serious, but it really did throw you on the mercy of all your neighbours and friends there. So.
Yeah, I think there's something in that vulnerability that we can sometimes go thinking we've got all the answers and we're the ones who's going to bring Jesus and we're going to change these people's lives. But actually, the people there, they had a lot to offer me as well. And they really became like family to me and they really cared about me. And that was really, it was just amazing to really be part of life with them there. And I think that's partly as well how I really got to understand some of the struggles of people living there, because I knew at any time I could get a plane out of there, I could leave, but they couldn't. They had to live in the reality of the situation there. And we just had so many occasions when we had to rely on local people to help us. So we had another situation where our area became under kind of like a military lockdown because one of the leaders of the kind of village area was in prison and he was on hunger strike. And so the Israeli army felt that this whole area became a threat. And so they kind of did this military lockdown. But we hadn't realized. And so we had gone out of the village without our car and we were just walking with our baby in a pram by the time we'd had the baby. And so we came to go back in and the whole, it was kind of like, it was crazy. It was like something out of a video game. There were just army soldiers everywhere and they all had the kind of flak jackets on and helmets and they were all carrying guns. And we just thought, how are we going to get back to our house? We're now trapped outside. The whole place is under this kind of military lockdown. And yeah, this Muslim family came along. It was a lady and her daughters in a car. And they just said to us, oh, do you need some help? And we said, we just don't know how to get back to our house now because we don't want to walk into this situation. And they just said, we'll look after you, don't worry. And they bundled us and someone took the baby and we all squeezed into the car. And And they drove us to our house and they made sure that we got in safely. Mm-hmm. And they just really looked after us. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there were so many situations where we just had to rely on our neighbours to help us.
That's precious because, you know, now you're back in the UK and we'll come on to this later, but now you're in a different role where you're welcoming and looking after refugees and asylum seekers at this end, understanding how vulnerable they can feel in a brand new culture, not quite understanding how things work, not hearing the news perhaps or what to do. So it's interesting, isn't it, how so much of what you learned about Arab hospitality and generosity was something you can now be reflecting at this end.
Yeah, exactly. You just get a whole understanding, I think, of what it's like to be removed from your own culture and put into a whole new culture in a way that if you don't have that experience, it's hard to imagine how difficult it can be. Mm.
Sharing this podcast is a really good way to encourage more people to get involved with God's great mission, whether locally or globally. So please do help us get the word out there. If you use an iPhone, it's pretty easy to write us a review, and that has a big impact on how many people can find us. Alternatively, you could share one of your favourite episodes with a few of your friends. Thanks, guys, and now let's get back to the podcast.
So, yeah, what other highlights were there or struggles out there for you?
So I think one of the real highlights for us was, I spoke earlier about just learning about prayer. And when we moved to Jerusalem, I just felt God really put on my heart to raise up prayer for Palestinian people. Just felt a real calling to do that. And so when we moved there, there were people scattered from our organization and from other organizations in different places around in the West Bank. So they're up in Hebron. There was a couple, and there was another couple in East Jerusalem from our organization. And then there was other organizations who were working in Bethlehem and different parts of the West Bank. And so when we moved there, I asked some of those people that we kind of met along the way, how are you praying? What are you doing? And there was a real sense that people wanted to pray, but no one was kind of unified in that. And so we met a lady actually who had a lot of experience with prayer. And so I said to her, shall we try and do something together with this? And so we set up a week of prayer and we invited every organization that we had kind of met, or we just got people to invite anyone who wanted to come, really, who had a heart for praying for the Palestinian people. And we started praying. Back in the day, it was Skype. We prayed over Skype because of the borders between the West Bank and Jerusalem, it was quite difficult to travel between those areas. Everything took twice as long as it should have done. And so it was quite hard to meet up regularly, but we would meet over Skype to pray. And we prayed until we did this week of prayer. And we actually gathered quite a lot of people came together to pray. And then we, from that, formed a group that we called the Palestinian Prayer Network. Mm. And we committed then to meet monthly as a group and to pray for Palestinians to come to know Jesus. And that was the focus of our prayers, was that people would hear the gospel and that they would come to know Jesus. Mm. So that was just a really special time, actually, of being able to meet with people and praying together. And just, we did a lot of prayer walks. We tried to do some more strategic prayer. And we gathered a lot of people to do that. And it's been a real encouragement to me, actually, that since we moved back, that is still going today and people are still meeting regularly and praying together.
That's really good. Tell us something about the Palestinian Christians out there. Did you have much interaction with them?
Yes. So there's actually an amazing group of Christians in Bethlehem and in some of the other cities, but many of them are in Bethlehem, and they have a Bible college in Bethlehem. And we did involve some of the Palestinian Christians as we kind of got going with the prayer. We invited them to join with us. And sometimes we would visit the Palestinian churches, which are kind of an experience because they're very noisy. They pack everyone into a tiny room, and then the worship is like through the roof. It is amazing, but it's also a little bit overwhelming, especially when we had small children. They found it a little bit much. But so I was involved in a reconciliation organization that brought together Palestinian Christians with Messianic Jewish Christians. And it's quite complicated, but the West Bank is segregated into areas. There's certain areas where Jewish people are allowed to come and certain areas where they're not. And so there's an area C, which anyone can go into. And there was a big convent there. And so we used to hold reconciliation events in that kind of neutral space. And there was actually an amazing group of Messianic Jewish Christian ladies. It was a lot of work was done actually between women and youth. And so I was really involved with the women mostly. And these ladies would gather together in this neutral area, which actually was, it was so courageous of both sides, because for the Jewish ladies to come into that West Bank area was very scary. And they'd heard a lot of stories of what Palestinians are like. And stepping into that place was a big step of faith for them. And for Palestinians, just to meet Jewish Christians was amazing. And it's very hard for Palestinian Christians. Their experience of Jewish people tends to be soldiers and checkpoints. And they never actually get to meet the rest of the population. And there's a lot of fear that comes from that, because if the only time you ever meet someone from a different people group is when they've got a gun and they're saying, yes, you can go through this checkpoint, or no, you can't go through this checkpoint, then that breeds a lot of fear. And so to bring these two groups together was really powerful. And there were times when it was hard and where their experiences just didn't mesh and there was a bit of conflict in that. But the whole point of the exercise really was just to say that we have a common savior, that Jesus is our savior. And even though we have these differences, we can share how we've experienced things and we can gain an understanding of each other's life. And we can know that we are sisters in Christ because Jesus died for all of us. And it was so powerful to see that happen. And I think that one of the things with the conflict actually is that there is so much fear involved and there's so much dehumanizing. So a lot of either population will never really have met someone from the other population. So their experience of who they are comes from what they see in the news or from what they're told. And so many people never actually get to meet someone from the opposite people group. And I think that one of the big things we learned there was, that just actually both sides are people, they're human, and there are difficult situations on both sides. Later on when we were there, I used to work with Muslim women and we ran courses in self-empowerment, in helping them to make good decisions. And I made a really good friend through that who was a social worker, and she was such a kind lady. And actually during the previous Gaza war, when things started just to get really difficult, and on both sides there was a lot of violence, and there was an explosion, a bomb actually, at a tram stop in Jerusalem, and a Jewish lady and her baby were killed, and it was just a horrible incident. And I had some Jewish friends with my children. We'd gone to kind of music events and things. And we had met a lot of Jewish women and children, and we'd made some friends. But it was really when that happened, and I thought, wow, that could have been me at that tram stop with my baby, because we went there all the time. It was a regular place we went. And it helped me to understand actually the fear that the Israelis feel, because when things like that happen, it's random and it could happen to anyone. And they see on the news that, oh, these are the people that have done this to you and you should hate them. But it really helped me actually to get an understanding of how both sides are experiencing that conflict and how that sows into how both sides view each other. And so this lady who I was working with, I said to her, oh, this is awful that this has happened. And she just said to me, oh, if you treat us like animals, we'll behave like animals. And it was kind of heartbreaking to me that this very kind lady, that was how she saw kind of Israeli Jewish people, that this is an inevitable consequence of what they've done and that there is no choice in the matter. And that was really sad to see that. There are so many things that until you kind of live there and are in those people's shoes, you can't understand why things are happening.
So how did, you know, the message of Jesus, the gospel, how were you able to bring some of that into these very real, very painful, very raw situations with a lot of emotions going on? I mean, were they happy to talk to you about your faith? Were they interested to hear stories of Jesus?
Yes, yeah, so we did have a lot of opportunities to share Jesus because it was such a difficult place to live. And there were some things that made sharing Jesus more difficult, I guess, because there's a lot of mention of Jewish people in the Bible. And so that made sharing from the Bible harder because we had to get over that barrier first. But we had a lot of opportunities just to share about Jesus as a peacemaker and as Prince of Peace, and to share stories of how Jesus had changed things in our life. And people were really receptive to hearing about that. And I'd say most of our conversation, we sowed a lot of seeds, we shared a lot. It was mostly kind of at the beginning of people's journeys where they had never heard any of these things before. And we were really praying into seeing a movement start of Palestinians coming to know Jesus. And so as part of that, we really were hoping to reach into family networks and to reach whole families. And me and a teammate together, we led these courses that I mentioned earlier with women, and we were able to go into neighborhoods and we'd sign up the ladies, and it was amazing to see they nearly all had the same surname. They were all related somehow. And we just were able to share some of the principles of the gospel with them through this course. And we had permission from the local imam to run the course, but it was very much based on biblical principles, and we were able to share scriptures with them. Some of the Psalms were really powerful for those women to hear, that they are created by a loving God and that they have a real purpose in life and that there is more to life than what they were living in their kind of day-to-day lived experience.
I mean, how do Palestinian Muslims generally look at Christians? I mean, you get the idea here in Britain from the Muslim community that they think that the West is always pro-Israel. So there's probably a feeling that, oh, you're against us Palestinians, you Christians, just side quickly with Israel. But then there's also another way to look at it, where actually Palestinian Muslims, in a sense, would see Christians in Palestine as, you know, our neighbours and those who are co-sufferers with us. And of course, they see Jesus as a prophet within Islam. So is it a very confused picture when you're out there?
Yes. I mean, it's a really interesting place to live, Jerusalem, because it's where the three religions, so Judaism, Islam, Christianity, intersect. And there's a lot of holy sites for each religion. And there's a real sense, actually, of spiritual battle there. And there's a real oppression, I would say, in the spiritual realm that you can sense all the time. And so, there's definitely that going on in the background. And then there are just lots of complicating factors where it's not just the message of Jesus that we've never heard before, but it comes with some baggage and some things that need to be dealt with. And actually, we found that the people who really did want to follow Jesus and who eventually came to follow Jesus, a lot of them actually experienced Jesus through prayer and through people just saying, let's listen to what God has got to say to us, and using some listening prayer. And actually, it was that real experience that drew people to Jesus, rather than a kind of factual
apologetic sort of argument,
because a lot of the apologetics would get mixed up in the political situation. And so actually trying not to make it about politics, or not even not trying to make it about politics, but just trying to actually get to the heart of you can encounter the living God. He cares about you. He wants to know you. And leading people into prayer and to encounter was much more fruitful than trying to persuade people with kind of logical arguments.
Yeah, really interesting. Yeah, do you have any other anecdotes or interesting stories for us?
Yeah, we did meet some really amazing people out there. My neighbour, for example, she was amazing, but she wasn't a very spiritual lady, actually. We were in and out of each other's houses. And she came over to me one day and said, Charlie, I think there might be an evil spirit in my house, which was completely out of the blue. Kind of, I'm thinking, wow, we've not had conversations like this before. Muslim women are really interesting. They appear very conservative from the outside, but when they invite you into their homes, they're not as conservative in the home as they are outside. And this lady was very modern in her outlook. She wasn't very religious. But yeah, she suddenly said, I actually think something spiritual is going on in my house. So I said to her, I could come and pray in your house. We could ask for the peace of Jesus to come. And she was a bit like, oh, I don't know about that. I think I'll call a Quranic expert to come and help. Mm-hmm. So I said, no, I'll come. It will help. And I went over to her house and I start to pray in her house in the name of Jesus. And as I pray, this enormous picture on her wall jumped off the wall and hit her. And it was kind of crazy. I was like, wow, God, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And she says to me, Charlie, you're making it worse. I think we need to stop. And I didn't actually have much experience in this kind of prayer. And I'm thinking, what do I do, Jesus? So I said to her, well, don't worry, let's take a break and we'll come back and pray again later. And so I did go another day and pray. Nothing weird happened, but she was still like, no, I don't think it's working. It's not working. Mm. And so I kind of left it and I felt like, oh no, God, I didn't really represent you well there. I didn't really know what I was doing. Mm. And I don't know that I really brought you well into that situation. And it was really interesting. She came back a few days later and she said, peace has come back to my house. I think it's solved. She said, I'm pretty sure it was my auntie. She came and read some Quranic verses. Mm. And I just felt, wow, I don't feel like Jesus was glorified in that at all. And it was really disappointing, I think, experience. Mm. But then she came over for coffee again about a week later. And she said, I've just had the weirdest dream. And she said, and in this dream, I just knew that you had come and brought the peace of God into my house. And again, it was very spiritual language from someone who wasn't very spiritual. And there was a whole long story about this dream, but she really felt that when I had come in, I'd brought God's peace with me. And it was amazing because I just felt like in that moment, God was saying, actually, you can trust me to do this. My Holy Spirit is at work in this situation. And maybe it didn't work out exactly how you would have wanted it to, but he spoke to her very clearly through this dream. And she was much more open after that. She didn't ever profess faith in Jesus, but we did have some amazing conversations after that. And I mean, in some of them she brought her most religious friend over to see if I might like to become a Muslim. but in a sense, it was an honor because she said to me, you're my sister and I want you to have what we've got. And I was able to share what I had in Jesus. Mm. And so it was actually an amazing opportunity to share with some of the other ladies.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. As you never quite know what you're going to face, do you? when someone calls you over. And we've had a few of those stories on this podcast before with all sorts of different results. Great. Bring us up to speed with what you do now, and now that you're back in the UK, and how your work here with immigrant families is going.
Yes, so we moved back about 8 years ago now, it was actually. Mm. And so when I moved back, I had two young children. So I worked part-time for the office here and I coordinated prayer. And I did that for a couple of years and then I had my third daughter. And that time I'd kind of been adapting back into culture in the UK. I just hadn't realized how difficult it would be to adapt back into British culture, which is my kind of culture, having lived amongst Muslims for so long. Mm. I remember I'd been in the garden and I walked into town wearing shorts. And as I got halfway, I thought, someone's going to see me wearing shorts. And in the Arab world, that's like a definite no. That's like a horrifying moment. And I remember thinking afterwards, oh, I'm in Britain. Like that's that's okay. It's okay to wear shorts in this country. But yeah, there was lots. It took a while to adapt. And I kind of wanted to make friendships with Palestinian women. And I wasn't really sure how to go about it. And I had met a couple of women in our area. There's a lot of Pakistani women, but I hadn't made any real deep friendships. And then I had my daughter. And while I'd been on maternity leave, I'd had a sense that God wanted me to shift my focus. So still to do prayer and work with Frontiers, but also to work with my church and in ministry with my church. Yeah. And I remember saying to God, well, I don't know how that's going to happen because there aren't any jobs available at church. And I just felt he called me to fast and pray about it. So I did. And I kind of was thinking, oh, I'm going to be doing this for a while. And 3 weeks later, out of the blue, I just got a call from my church saying, we've decided to create a position. running the toddler groups at church. You're a volunteer there already. Would you like that job? Mm. And I kind of wasn't sure because I'd never done that before. And and I had done a lot of work in prayer and leading teams, but I'd never worked with toddlers. Mm. So it was a mother and toddler group. And I thought, oh, well, I really enjoy being there. It's a good place to meet women. And so I took that job, and the very first week that I started there, I sat down next to a lady, and she was obviously Muslim. She was wearing a headscarf, and I said to her, oh, where are you from? And she said, oh, I'm from Jerusalem. And I thought, oh, wow, that's amazing. And I said to her, oh, where did you live? I used to live there. And she said, oh, I come from this tiny little area. You'll never have heard of it. And it was the exact area that I'd lived in the whole time I was so in cool. Jerusalem. And then she said, well, which house did you live in? Because everyone there knows everyone else. And so I'm explaining to her exactly where and which family I lived with. And she said, oh, that's my husband's uncle. And she said, and my family live across the street from there. Amazing. And it was just amazing. And so she had come to Britain the same year that we had gone to Jerusalem. So we'd never met each other there. Mm-hmm. But it was just amazing. I had literally walked that whole place in prayer for hours and hours on end. And when I had my son, and we didn't have a team at the time, we were still recruiting team members, which turned out to be quite difficult because nobody wanted to move to our crazy area. And I just used to spend my time, a lot of my time in prayer. And I used to lay hands on that building and pray for the people inside it. And so to go to my church here and meet one of those family members that I've been praying for all this time was just amazing. I just felt God affirming to me, actually, this is the right place. Because I had been questioning, should I be working with mothers and toddlers? It's a whole new thing. But I just felt him saying, and that lady was a real gatherer and a bringer, and she brought all her friends. And so actually, I then had a group of Syrians and Lebanese ladies, Egyptians, and she would bring them all, and they would all want to speak Arabic to me because nobody spoke Arabic. So then that was a chance to meet so many Arab women in our area and just spend time with them. And just to go much deeper with them. And then in fact, she brought another lady from Hebron to the group a few weeks later. And actually a few months later. And I said to this lady, oh, which part of Hebron were you in? And she was telling me, and I said, oh, I had a friend, the lady actually who I started the prayer network with, who lived there. And I said, she's an American lady. And she said, oh, Karen. And I was like, yes. And it was just amazing that she had been one of her students, and she had spent time with this lady, and she had really sowed into her life. And there she was in my church as well. And it just felt like God was just really honoring all those prayers that we'd prayed over so long. And he was kind of saying to us, you know, you might have had to move away. And actually she had to move away, my friend as well, because the visa situation there was very difficult. And and many people had to leave over the years because their visas couldn't be renewed. And so I was able to call my friend and say, you know, God's still working in this. And and he's still working in the lives of these women, which was amazing to see.
That is awesome. Yeah, we have such a small understanding of God's sovereignty, don't we, and how he moves people around the world and brings his people alongside those who are seeking him. And we'll never know, probably, until we get to heaven as to all the different connections and fruit that he's been planning.
Yeah, it's true. Actually, when I moved back to the UK, I hadn't wanted to leave where we were in the Middle East. And it was very, and I know most people are thinking, oh, I'd never want to live in the Middle East. You'd have to drag me there. But it did feel like God dragged me back from the Middle East. And I didn't want to live here because I felt a real calling to that people. And that was what I'd wanted to dedicate my life to. And when I took the job actually at Frontiers in the office here, leading prayer, I had a kind of vision from God, and it was quite unusual for me. I'd not really experienced that before, but I just felt God showed me that when I was in this vision, I'd kind of got to heaven, and there was this huge queue of people, and they were all coming to thank me for helping to lead them to Jesus. And one of my sadnesses in leaving the Middle East was we hadn't seen much fruit, and we hadn't seen people come to see Jesus, to know Jesus. And there was like person after person, and I said to God in this kind of experience, well, I didn't lead anyone to faith. Who are these people and why are they thanking me? And he said to me that that his kingdom purposes weren't over. And actually, that as I raised up prayer for the Muslim world and I raised up prayer for this people group and for other people groups, through those prayers, many Muslims were going to come to faith in Jesus. And I just thought it was such a powerful experience to see that God works through all of us and we can all be involved, actually. Even if we never get to go to the Middle East, we can be praying and we can sow into those parts of the world that we may never see and we may never know until we get to eternity the impact that our prayers have and the impact that sowing into things has. Even though we've never met those people, we have a part to play in their story and the part to play in God's kingdom coming into their lives.
That's so good. What an encouragement that is, yeah, to all of us. I suppose that would be a good place to wrap up and tell us how people can get involved with praying for the Muslim world, praying for Frontiers, praying for our workers all around the world in sometimes dangerous and difficult places. Yeah, what would be some practical ways people could get involved?
Yeah, so we have some different things that we produce here in the office. We produce a weekly prayer guide, so you can pray for 10 minutes a day. You can give an hour of your week over, or you can just dip in and out if you like to. And we pray through the whole of the Muslim world throughout the year. We've recently put that into an app, which you can also set to pop up every day. It just reminds me every day that I need to be praying. And that's really helpful. We also have Ramadan prayer guides. That will be coming up. And there's the 30-day prayer guide, which you can access through a written copy or in a PDF. And I think you can learn about new places as well and just find out what's going on there and just use that learning, use what you hear in the news just to pray into to some of those situations.
Yeah, definitely. And so people can find those. Maybe we can put a link in the blurb for this episode, but also they could go to our website and look up the Pray Now app.
So on our website, it's under Pray Now. So it should be quite easy to find, hopefully. And you can always get in touch with us. We can always send you some more information.
Yeah.
And we can also connect you into groups who are praying for different things as well.
Yeah, that's right. And I know there are lots of universities where students are praying for the Muslim world as well around this country, which is fantastic. Great. Charlie, Charlotte, it's been so good to have you with us today. Thank you for, just giving us that little window into life in Jerusalem and your years out there and all that you've learned and how God shaped you through that. It's really exciting to hear about your journey. And let's keep praying, all of us, for the Middle East and especially, of course, for that part of the world where there's so much trouble right now.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, they really do need your prayers right now.
All right. Great to be with you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks so much for joining us today, guys. For more, check out our website, frontiers.org.uk, our social media platforms at frontiers.uk, or you can email me personally, matt@frontiers.org.uk. Here's a great quote to end with today from James Calvert. When he went out as a missionary to the cannibals of the Fiji Islands, the ship's captain tried to turn him back, saying, "You will lose your life and the lives of those with you." But James replied, "We died before we came here." Have a great week and make sure you don't miss our next episode.